Time to take a look at our Wisconsin climate and weather. Well, not only Wisconsin. We'll talk Wisconsin a lot, but I guess climate implies maybe the whole world here. As we visit with John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve Ackerman, normally with us, professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. He directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, but he's got some tough duty.
Yeah, he's got some tough duty. And I'd have to correct you, Larry. He's normally here. He's not always with us, as I think you know. But yeah, he's in Amsterdam, Holland today for the week, so that's pretty exciting.
And we've got some warm weather across a good part of the state, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, it's just amazing. I mean, and it looks like with a couple of interruptions this week, it's going to sustain itself through the first few days of October. We're going to be above normal through 3rd or 4th of October, it looks like.
Yeah, it's pretty warm out there today.
Oh, man, I couldn't believe it. I volunteered to walk from my kid's school, which is maybe a mile or so west of here, because of a family situation, and I had a jacket on, and it felt like middle of July by the time I got to work. 61 dew point. You don't expect that.
Oh, you sure don't. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call for you to join in with your questions. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And email us at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We'll be glad to get you on the air. And this, I was trying to remember last September if it was, was it that warm?
I remember it being fairly nice, but I don't remember temperatures over 80 so frequently, although it's only recollection, so I don't have the data in front of me to verify that. But it does seem like it's been a warmer September than last year's. I agree.
And what are we looking for as just a, have you looked ahead yet to see what we're kind of expecting for winter?
Actually, no, I have not done that. I know that there's no signal in the tropical Pacific Ocean, which often has some influence on our weather. When the tropical Pacific Ocean temperatures are warmer than normal at about the dateline, we tend to be warmer and wetter in the wintertime. And that there is no such signal there now. So what that maybe means is that we have equal chances for a regular Wisconsin-type winter where it's cold and maybe a little snowy. Although, again, it's a little bit early to have any confidence in that. And even when those forecasts come out for the next 3 months, they're not made in the same way that the 2-, 3-, and 4-day forecasts are made in the broadcast media. It's a very different process.
You know, speaking of broadcast media, somebody asked me, what kind of training do you need to be a meteorologist? You know, most of them, I believe, have gone through a university, UW or one.
Yeah, broadcast meteorologist. Increasingly so. 20 years ago or so, there was a big push put on by the American Meteorological Society to ensure that people who were delivering weather news on the TV and on the radio to a lesser extent actually had a bachelor's degree in atmospheric science or meteorology specifically. And they've reached a 85 to 90% level on that across the country, which is a huge difference from 30 years ago when it wasn't required.
And what are what are the types of courses a person would take to meet that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Meteorology is a study of the atmosphere and how it works as a physical system. And so we speak in the language of calculus. You need to know your calculus to be able to formulate expressions that will describe how this fluid behaves. And then you also have to be well-versed in physics, so that's a large part of our prerequisite courses. And then once you get into the major as an undergraduate, you have to take a course in thermodynamics and atmospheric physics. How does the water substance, for instance, change its phase, and what are the implications for that in the atmosphere? Then there's a course in radiative transfer. Most of the energy that drives the whole thing comes from the sun, so we have to understand how energy is transferred by radiation. And then you'll take a course in dynamics. How do you describe the behavior of a fluid? It's different from describing the behavior of a solid in the presence of forces like gravity and various other ones. And so that takes up a whole year. And then when a person's a senior, they try to apply all of those different things to the study of large-scale cyclones, the kind that get us in the fall and the winter, and mm-hmm. then they'll apply the same set of rules to much smaller-scale phenomena like severe weather and tornadoes and things like that in the spring. And then along the way, we also want them to get an idea of how that whole physical picture of local weather fits into the climate picture. So we try and get a sense of that as well in the large-scale circulation of the atmosphere. So it's a rigorous science, and I think it's usually not perceived as such because of the extreme contact that we have with the public, which is usually with a celebrity-type person They all know their stuff, and they're physicists. They're applied physicists.
Well, that could scare off a lot of people.
Oh, I don't want to scare them off, because here's the thing. Now, here's the thing. I tell my students this all the time. When you're first interested in it as a kid, it's because of the phenomenology. You're thrilled by thunderstorms. You're thrilled by snowstorms like I was as a kid. And then at first, when you start to study it formally, at least it happened to me, I was a little bit turned off. I thought, we're not talking enough about the phenomena. But after a while, very short while, in fact, I realized that being able to talk about these things in detailed mathematical and physical terms was a lot more exciting than just talking about them with your friend down the street. And that's true to this day. I mean, I still find that fascinating. So put up with that little bit of disappointment at the beginning, and it'll pay off.
You know, we're getting pretty good at predicting, especially in the short term. You've talked about this in the past, but within a day or 24 or 48 hours, we're pretty darn accurate.
Really accurate. If you keep score at home, you'll be amazed. And I'd say that's even extended now to the 3- and 4-day range. And at certain times of year, it extends to the 7-day range. Our recent wet spell there in August in the southern part of the state, I remember saying this on the air, we had 7 days' notice that we were going to have a soggy week that week. I don't think anybody knew 15 inches of rain or whatever it was in Madison was going to fall. But everybody knew it was going to rain moderately or heavily a couple of times during that next week, a week in advance. This is phenomenal. And it's something that we, I think, take for granted in our society, the ability to forecast the weather to the degree that we do with accuracy. And everyone will be able to come back, all of us, you and me included, will be able to come back with stories where we had a plan made because of a forecast and it went bust. But keep track of how often that's the case, and I guarantee it'll be 1 in 5, 1 in 6 will be like that.
And speaking of that, I was reading that in New Orleans just recently, the people were kind of upset because the forecasted weather was more severe than actually occurred, and a lot of people said, "Well, you made a mountain out of a molehill."
That's a good, at some sensitive places and sensitive areas, place like New Orleans in the aftermath of Katrina, and we're really 2 years past, but nothing's changed down there. It's a pretty bad situation in a lot of places, so they're a little bit sensitive to the possibility of another hurricane, as you might imagine. Mm-hmm. And that system that came through there, I forget the name of it now off the top of my head, but a couple of weeks ago, developed almost in situ, right there in the northern Gulf of Mexico. It looked like it was just going to be a weak, barely tropical depression status, and overnight, it turned into a Category 1 hurricane. And that scares people. The word hurricane as opposed to tropical depression scares them, especially in New Orleans. And I think it was the right thing to tell people because it turned out to be the correct statement. But hurricane means something different in New Orleans than it used to.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be quite as bad as Katrina when you get a Category 1.
John Martin, our guest, as we talk climate and weather with him. If you want to join in with your own questions and comments, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Give us a call with your questions or comments, or send us an email, and we'll get you. We'll read what you have to say to us as we move along here today. And some callers coming on online here, as a matter of fact, and maybe we'll take a call from Andrew in the Fox Valley, I believe, is coming up now. So let's see if we can go to Andrew in the Fox Valley. Let me try that. Let's see. Andrew, are you there?
In many, many millennia ago, and the different dynamic that was there.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. What was your question again, Andrew? I'm sorry.
My question was, is there any study done to see what the climate was like many millennia ago, the different dynamics of that?
Yeah, didn't mean to interrupt you.
And just how does that relate to the current climate? Because we keep talking about climate change, and there was a very different equilibrium of climate, for example, during the time of the dinosaurs. We all heard about lush and tropic and very hot and very different climate dynamics.
Yeah, people do study that. It's called paleoclimatology.
Okay.
And so people are studying not only the near term, the sort of last 25,000 years, which is in some ways has more data because you can go through peat bogs and various other types of geological formations and actually get information from pollen and from other types of proxy data to really reconstruct in some detail what the climate history of, say, southern Wisconsin was for the last 25,000 years. And you can say that with strong confidence. Understanding what some of the parameters of the climate system were 25,000 years ago and constructing it from 25,000 years ago to the present day allows us to understand the magnitude of the fluctuations that, that nature has had in it sort of inherently before humankind was able to sort of radically change land use and atmosphere composition and various other things. And that helps us to make a good guess, not a guess, but an educated guess about how what we're currently doing is far in excess of what was the case on the planet thousands and millions of years ago.
And we'll be back with our guest, John Martin, in just a couple of minutes. Stay with us. We're taking a look now at climate and weather with one of our weather guys, John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. With us today, Steve Ackerman is off to Amsterdam. He would normally be along as well today, but he's doing some things relating to climate and weather, and we'll probably get a report from him the last Monday of next month, because these guys always come along the last Monday of the month. Appreciate your calls and questions. Here's that number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Somebody was wondering about how do you construct the weather from the climate from 25,000 years ago? And I'm sure that John has some things to say about that. And we'll take your questions as well right after this look at the news. Please stay with us. Talking climate and weather now with our weather guy, John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. If you'd like to join in, the number is 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, reach us at 263-1890. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Give us a call and we'll be glad to put you on the air or send us an email. And John, let's talk a little bit more about the paleoclimatology and how you actually go about constructing the weather or the climate from 25,000 years ago.
Yeah, I think the best you can hope for is you can construct the past climate, and that's probably in the tens of thousands of years in the past is probably about as far as you can go at the level of detail that I'm talking about. And you do it through analyzing data that you find in various geological formations. I think some in our own state are like peat bogs. And you can get radiocarbon dating of how old the pollen is or tree rings too for shorter time periods than that. And you can get a sense of when it was wet, when it was dry, when it was cold and warm, and really reconstruct a pretty accurate a sort of reconstruction of the climate. And if you have several such sites around a place, then you can get a really good coherent picture of what it was like regionally instead of just at one site. To go back millions of years, I think, requires actually high-speed computers and trying to model the climate in the past. And that will also involve assimilation of some really old data that you can sometimes get. We know something about solar cycles. We know something about eccentricity of the Earth's orbit and various things as this. And they influence how much solar radiation is absorbed or at various latitudes on Earth. Trying to figure out what the composition of the atmosphere was millions of years ago, I can't speak to that. I don't know how people do that. But I think it's, again, more than a guess. It's an educated guess with the help of a numerical forecast model or a numerical climate model, I should say.
Let's take some calls. Bill in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Bill. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks, Larry.
Sure.
I got a question for Professor Martin. We went to Alaska, to Valdez, actually, in 1978, and took a small boat cruise out in Edward Sound to the right near the Columbia Glacier, and there was like a vertical wall.
Yeah.
It was just tremendous to see. Then we went back 9 years later, 1987, and that glacier, instead of having a vertical face, had receded a mile, and it was just a bunch of icebergs out in the bay. Now, we really hadn't been talking about man's effect on climate. Could that have been natural climate change that would recede a glacier a mile right after 78?
It's hard for me to exclude that as a possibility, although the evidence to the other story is mounting and is becoming extremely convincing that it is a human-induced change, especially true at high latitudes. That's what we're finding out quite recently, last 4 or 5 years.
That but could it have started in 78?
Sure, yeah, it certainly could have. I think what's happening now in terms of our understanding of human-induced climate change is that we're starting to see signals of a process that's been going on for 100 years. And so it's an integrated process. You're just adding little stones to the pile, little by little, over 100 years. And not till it gets to be a certain weight do you start to see some of the aftermath of that process. And I think at high latitudes, and this is what the climate scientists are saying, I've got a colleague who works in the polar latitudes now on this problem, at the high latitudes, we're starting to see the most alarming and most dramatic changes, and they may well have begun, you know, around 1980, as in terms of begun, meaning you can start to see the changes. This year, I think, we're still not to the point where the Arctic sea ice is going to start reforming, and currently, this year, we are 20% more open in the Arctic than any prior year, which is an alarming departure from the average. One could imagine that you could have a 1 or 2% more open Arctic Ocean. We have a 20% more open Arctic Ocean this year in the Northern Hemisphere as a consequence, we believe, of the change in the climate both in the atmosphere and in ocean circulations that are related, of course, to the atmosphere. So this is an alarming thing, and it is preponderantly happening at the high latitudes right now. So
were there records effect back then? Do we have records?
At least as early as immediate post World War II, because we were concerned, of course, about the North Pole as a route by which the Soviet Union might decide to invade the Western Hemisphere, and so there's a lot of, in fact, there's still a lot of classified information apparently on submarine patrols in the Arctic. So there really is a very good record for the last 50 or so years of Arctic sea ice coverage throughout the year, and we're able to make a statement that we're at least 20% more than that, because we're talking about 20% less than the prior record in those 50 years. So the Arctic sea ice coverage is vastly decreased in those 50 years.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Now, this morning, I was up early and had several meetings, and I only had a chance to just glance at the Wisconsin State Journal, but there was an article on the front page that had to do with climatologists, and I didn't get a chance to read it, only the extent. It was right on the bottom of the first page. And
I didn't see it.
It was, what it was relating to, and you might comment on this, was climatologists are saying we still have time to turn this around, and we shouldn't view this whole situation as totally lost, and that we should look at more positive light in some ways. There are things we can do.
I did see that article, and it quoted Jim Hansen from NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Goddard Institute for Space Studies, which is in New York City, right there on Broadway. In fact, it's on the corner from the restaurant that Seinfeld and his friends always meet in. That's a fact. And they gave it a fake address, too, because in the 1960s it was under attack by people on Columbia University. You know, they didn't want any NASA on Columbia University in the 1960s. But anyway, that's beside the point. But Hansen has been a long-standing vocal advocate of, let us please clean up our act. We've got mounting evidence that we're influencing the Earth's climate in a way that we can't control if we let it get out of hand. And so it's really particularly compelling to hear him say, we're not at doomsday yet. But it's going to take concerted effort. It's going to take real, genuine leadership, which is looking ahead decades and saying, for the sake of our children's children, we need to make some changes now in the way we do business, the way we provide energy to our economy. And it can't happen overnight, but we can't keep saying it can't happen overnight, therefore let's do nothing. And I think that's what he's saying. And he's right.
It's an interesting I'm going to read that article when I get back to my office. Talking climate and weather today with our guest John Martin. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. You know, a few weeks ago, I was in northern Wisconsin, and I was talking about rain. You mentioned rain in southern Wisconsin in August, and I tell you, in some areas in the northern Wisconsin, they would have loved to have had half of those 15 or 16 inches we got here in the south.
Yeah, absolutely. I was up on the peninsula. I was lucky enough to get up there in Washington Island the first week of August, and everything was brown. It was remarkably dry. Didn't look anything like the southern part of the state. And in the central part of the state, I think, also had a period of lack of precipitation. So although I think theirs has been remedied, I'm not so sure it's been remedied at the highest northern cities in the state, Ashland, Bayfield area, Superior area. I don't think they've really gotten a lot of rain yet.
No, I don't think they have either. And I tell you what, every one of our lines is filled, so let's take some calls here. Some people waiting to get on. David in Ironwood, Michigan, it's your turn. Hi, Dave.
Yeah. Did you happen to see that one NOVA special about the Precambrian extinction? They were saying that volcanoes were erupting and literally caused global warming back then. And they figured the ocean temperature got to a point of so warm that they started to have fish die off and stuff. I just was wondering, have there been much research as far as how warm the oceans get before it affects the photoplankton and the fish life in the ocean? And they said that anaerobic bacteria can actually move into the seawater if it gets too low in oxygen content.
Yeah, in fact, one of my colleagues, who's now at the University of Texas Arlington, studied the Precambrian extinction from the climate point of view, both the ocean circulations and the atmosphere. And that's exactly what they concluded, is that it's called anoxia, when the ocean becomes starved of oxygen. And that can be for a number of different reasons. When it gets warm enough, it affords opportunity for life for certain kinds of organisms that really can wreak havoc on the chemical composition and the ability to retain oxygen of the water, and that turns into a big problem. So there's a conspiracy, a circumstance, they think, that occurred around the Precambrian extinction, and it was a mass extinction, the biggest one ever in the planet's history. 96 or 98% of existing life forms disappeared at that point. In the Earth's history. And it had something to do with the young geology of the planet, as well as you point out, with the volcanoes and changing the chemical composition, but also changing the temperature and oxygen content of the ocean water. Yeah, profound mystery to this day how exactly it all worked, but we're starting to get a couple of insights. How exactly they go about tracing that stuff back, I do not know. It's not my field, but they end up coming up with some conclusions that are replicated.
Interesting. Mark in Onalaska, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, or afternoon, I guess it is. I just heard from a colleague about some large fires in coal fields in India and in China that were emitting tremendous amounts of CO2 relative to, you know, other man-made sources.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just curious if, in perspective, what that means, if that's in fact true, or if they could control them. How that might help out as far as greenhouse gases?
Well, it would certainly help, but I think that the preponderance of the greenhouse gas loading in the atmosphere is done by industry, and these local hotspots that they'll probably become contained over some period of time. They certainly add to that problem, but they don't really create it in the way that having a civilization that depends on the automobile and hydrocarbon fuels to the extent that ours does. And again, this is not finger-pointing. It's just it's a historical fact. We're in a position where we are relying on those fuels. And so that loads a lot more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than local fires and coal facilities. But a lot of soot can be put into the atmosphere by coal fire, and that can be a problem that we're trying to better understand. What's the role of these aerosols, these sooty aerosols in the climate problem? It's not well understood.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Sure.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Speaking of aerosols, and before we go to Chuck next, I was trying to remember. Was it back in the 70s when your hairsprays and all the aerosol cans?
Oh, yeah.
There was a big push to eliminate those, and I'm seeing more of them. I don't know if it's the same kind of aerosol, but it seems like I'm seeing more of those aerosols coming back a bit.
I think that the particular chemicals that we tried to eliminate, CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, they lock up ozone in the high reaches of the stratosphere, 50 or so kilometers above the ground, 30 miles. And they are that's a really bad idea because we don't have very much ozone in our stratosphere. Wow. But the fact that we have any is what allows you and I to be talking to each other today, because if we didn't have it, we'd have ultraviolet radiation reaching the surface of the Earth and frying our DNA. And we would not have reasonable-looking kids. And we'd be extinct. So this small amount of ozone has got to be protected. And one of the ways in which we found out through scientific analysis that it was being depleted was by being locked up with these CFCs that are in aerosol cans. The industry has changed the way it creates an aerosol can. It doesn't use the same chemicals. And as a consequence, last fall, and this is the beginning of the ozone depletion in the southern hemisphere over the pole, right in the late September, last fall we reached a minimum in the amount of ozone there, after a steady decline or 2 years ago, and then it started to peak up last year. So this is a triumph of science informing policy. It should be a model for the way we approach our global warming problem. A bunch of industrializing nations and industrial nations got together in 1987 in Montreal, Canada, adopted something called the Montreal Protocol. It's been outstandingly successful in protecting our very important ozone layer, and it banned these CFCs once and for all. And industry found a way. It always does.
Yeah.
You know, business will find a way around the obstacles that good public policy puts in its way. It always does.
And the result has been very, very
been
good for all of us.
Extremely successful, you bet.
Chuck in Madison, your turn next. Hi, Chuck.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering, how has global warming affected the jet stream? Has it changed it much, or what's going on there?
How has global warming affected the jet stream?
That's a great question. And in fact, that's where, for my interest, because I study weather systems, and so they're related directly to the jet stream, that's where, for me, the intersection of these climate change issues and weather systems is currently very exciting. And we have a colleague on campus, one of my colleagues, who's been studying exactly that, finding out whether or not the storm tracks and the jet stream are being affected in simulations of future climate, and they're finding that indeed they are. The storm track moves further north and tends to be populated by slightly more intense and more frequent storms, but north of where they usually occur. And that's a problem because those storms, the kind that I study, without reference to the climate system, those storms are what feed the groundwater in the central part of North America, for instance, and give us all of our, or larger part of our precipitation for the entire year comes from organized weather systems that pay attention to the position of the jet stream. So if that all shifts further north, you're going to suddenly have considerably drier conditions in central North America than we do now, and that's bad because that's the breadbasket.
Yeah.
So people are studying that. It's a great question and a very exciting one.
Thank you very much for calling, Chuck. Mary in Madison, it's your turn next. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Yes, I recently saw a program on NOVA, excuse me, and it was discussing greenhouse gases, but it also addressed what they call a dimming of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And they illustrated like a pollen grain, and it was encased with a droplet of water, and then another droplet, you know, formed and it fell. And then they showed soot particle enlarged, and it had all these tiny droplets.
Mm-hmm.
And these tiny, excuse me, droplets would reflect the sun.
Yes.
Now, can you, I know there's physics and chemistry involved, but and gravity involved in these two illustrations, but what keeps the soot particle up? Is it the tiny droplets?
Soot particles can remain suspended depending on where they are in the atmosphere in particular, because they're not very massive. They don't have a lot of weight. So they're not going to fall very fast. And their terminal velocity, the velocity at which friction slows them down to a crawl, is very, very small. And so in the atmosphere, there's locations all through the atmosphere where there are gentle updrafts or downdrafts of air. And the updrafts are more than sufficient, even when they're weak, to sustain a lot of these particles for a long time. They don't stay up forever, but they stay up for a pretty good time, several weeks, depending on the size of the particle. And they tend to do very well as suspended particles in the lower part of the stratosphere on our planet. Now, here's the problem that we don't understand yet. There's two potential things that can happen with these soot particles. Number one, they can reflect solar radiation, and this accounts for this dimming of the sun, so that the sun is not any dimmer than it used to be. But the Earth has a canopy over it of fine soot particles. They come from industrialization, a lot of them. And so there may be an effect of industrialization that reflects more solar radiation before it gets to the surface of the Earth. If that's true, that actually works in favor of mitigating against a global warming. However, it may also be that these soot particles, because they usually are a dark material, they'll absorb solar radiation themselves as little individual pieces of matter. They may absorb solar radiation, that the part that doesn't get reflected, and if they absorb it at the wrong spot in the atmosphere, they can change the way that weather systems are going to develop and therefore be able to precipitate over the locations on Earth where we are used to them precipitating, and therefore we have developed agriculture. So there's two possible ways that the soot particles' presence could affect the climate, and they do not work together, those ways. They're completely different. And so that's a big topic of uncertainty and a big topic of research right now. So the so-called aerosol direct and aerosol indirect effects on the climate system. Not well understood. Sorry?
Stratosphere, could you define that?
Yeah, the stratosphere is a region on where we live anyway, in the middle latitudes. The stratosphere is usually at about 5.5 to 6 miles above the Earth. That's where it begins, and then it extends all the way up to about 30 miles. So it's the layer of the atmosphere just above the so-called troposphere in which we live, and that's where most of the weather is created, in the troposphere. The stratosphere sits right above it.
Hmm. Thank you very much for calling, Mary. Appreciate it. Anastasia in Salem, your turn. Hi there. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for talking about such an important topic today. I have been following this for about 20 years. I'm not that old, so I started pretty young, actually. But I want to know what types of journals, scientific journals and stuff, that you would recommend reading about, because I get all the basic stuff, and it's all the same stuff anymore. And I'd like to go a step further. I'd like to read a little more of what's new, what's starting to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if there's scientific journals, some books maybe that are written for the scientific community that I wouldn't be able to get any other way, but through that kind of stuff.
And you're talking about global warming here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, there's a first I'll give you the scholarly journals that I think you might find some interesting things in. One of them, probably a good one, although it doesn't often have climate articles. When it does, they're going to be short and right to the point, and that's Nature or Science. Either of those two will be a pretty good place to find brand new and short articles on brand new advances in our science, especially with respect to climate, because Nature and Science are both sort of sexy journals. And if you're just doing weather system stuff, they don't even want to talk to you. But if it's something of groundbreaking in the climate realm, they'll put it in there. So that's one place. Another is the so-called Journal of Climate, which is published by the American Meteorological Society. You can find that on the web. The Journal of Climate is dedicated to a range of climate type issues, not just global warming, but other ones as well. That's another good place to look. Then in terms of popular books, at the bookstore or something, there's one called The Weathermakers that I've seen, and I read a little bit about it, a little of it. It isn't the best book. I think it suffers, as a lot of these popular science books does, from too little actual, by the author, too little submitting manuscripts to real scientists and saying, is this accurate? You know, a lot of stuff gets through that's not accurate. But nonetheless, you get a good overview of the nature of the problem, and you'll be exposed to a bunch of names of people who are thinking about these issues as well. So it's probably good from that perspective. And there may be others that I just can't think of off the top of my head, but I'd start with those.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate the call very much. And Steve, and John,
yeah.
Thank you. I'll tell you what, John is sitting in the chair that Steve normally sits in.
Yeah, I lost my home field advantage.
I lost his home field advantage. John Martin, our guest today, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. And he'll be back next month. Maybe Steve will be with us, Steve Ackerman from the UW, or maybe not. I think he'll be back from Amsterdam by then.
He will be back from Amsterdam. I think he is going to be here next month, yeah.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to that. Last Monday of the month, always, the weather guys are with us. Steve Ackerman, John Martin, John with us today. Always fun. And thanks for listening. Just to let you know, tomorrow at 11, Dr. Lowell Lakritz will be on to talk about good dental care. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.